gladly discuss it with you. Number one is proof of God's existence. This is a problem that comes up whenever you speak to people who are intellectually curious. Proof of God's existence, proof of Torah min ha-shamayim. You have number three, understanding seeming contradictions between science and Torah. Again, a very, very common problem. The fourth is, what is tefillah? Now, what I imagine the problem that comes up is usually, how does tefillah help? How does it fit in the whole relationship between Hashem and the human being? I mean, how can we affect Hashem's decision? Probably that's what is the main problem. Now, number five, free choice and destiny. We already discussed that. We already discussed number six, the importance of Talmud Torah for its own sake, the idea of the, remember we spoke about the two inyonim. Number seven, why do we need so many mitzvos? Okay, maybe we'll discuss that part or something. Women's role in Judaism, but we'll discuss it some other time. What is the essential difference between a Jew and a Goy? Major problem. We have a basic sense of fairness, which is very strongly affected by our sense of difference. There is a difference, but how can there be a difference? It's unfair. And the number 10, the topic is, what is Eilu Ve'ilu Divar Elokim Chaim? Why are there machlokas in halokas? If anybody else has any other ideas, yeah?
Dealing with the use of Kedusha, how to deal with the physical world and not have it separate from a spiritual world. Like, how do we explain that to them?
What do you mean? How do we explain to them the idea of Kedusha?
Yeah.
What do you mean? The idea of to be Mekadesh the physical?
Right, exactly.
To be Mekadesh the physical. Okay, I'll add it as part of the topics, the idea of to be mekadesh the physical. What does it mean exactly? Okay.
Probably not also the concept of
tumah and tyra.
Yeah.
What is the concept of the tumah and tyra? Okay. Okay. Any other
State of Israel,
a major. Major problem.
Okay.
What? Some people ask, what is the purpose of you being here?
Some the purpose. You mean human beings in the world, Jews in the world, or just as a connection? Okay, that is part of the subject of Jews and Goyim. I mean, if we know the idea of purpose, then we know the difference between Jews and Goyim. You're right. Okay, let's. Okay, any other? Yeah.
I don't know. I was once asked to explain what Kabbalah is.
Oh, what do you mean? The overall, it's a difficult. I mean, there is a tremendous desire of understanding Kabbalah. I mean, it's a problem. It's a problematic subject. Anything else? Okay, let's start from the beginning. You have here the problem. How do we approach the question? Prove to me that there is a God. I mean, that's a question that goes all the way back to Chazal. You know, we find already Midrashim that talk about the idea, if you see something, the classical approach, if you see something planned, obviously there is a planner, right? The famous example of a beautiful painting or a letter written, and someone says, the inkwell spilled, and this is how it came out into the beautiful painting or the beautiful poem, whatever you however you want to describe it. Right? That is the classical approach. There must be someone who planned everything which exists. Now, but you have to realize the problem of proof. Besides mathematics, outside of mathematics, yeah. Usually, people who actually want to be convinced, they just don't see the logic of believing in God. Right? We are not talking about committed atheists. Usually, you won't get the question from committed atheists. You'll get the question from people who just want to know. Just prove it to me. I mean, how you say God, well, prove it. Can you prove it to me? Can you prove to me the existence of God? You know, people out of curiosity. They ask you to prove to them that there is
one of the top subjects on their priorities in life.
Again?
It's not one of their highest priorities, but it's just interesting.
Right, it's a curiosity. That's the truth of the matter is that we might think that that is a... That's part of what I wanted to tell you. We might think that that makes the difference. If you can convince them that there is a God, that's it. That it really, really bothers them. From experience, I want to tell you that very, very few people are really bothered by it. As something that really bothers them, it doesn't bother them. But very often you have to explain something, give it a logical expression, even something that doesn't bother them, because when a person commits himself to Yiddishkeit, to Torah, it's not really a logical decision. This is the conclusion after dealing with perhaps thousands of people who are on their way of becoming Baal Tshuva. I'm convinced now that I've never convinced anyone of accepting Yiddishkeit. The most I can say that I succeeded is by little overcoming the barriers. In other words, when the basic need or tendency is with the person, all of a sudden there, let's call it the Yetzer Hara, builds up barriers. But how can you really believe in that? Because after all, how do you know that there is a God? Which means, usually, it's not that my convincing them that there is a God is what's going to convince them to become frum. Their basic drive to become frum is within them, and it came obviously from the depth of their neshama. We had nothing to do with it. You sense that it's something that stems from within them. But their Yetzer Hara builds up resistance to that natural drive to what the Nitzotzos, the Holy God, sparks are driving towards. And that Yetzer Hara takes certain shapes and forms. One of the shapes and forms that it takes is questions. Okay? So in that, we can be helpful. What I'm saying then is that you can never convince anybody of anything, because it's not exact logic. It's not like mathematics. I can convince you that 2 and 2 is 4, but I can't convince you of inexact logic. There is always a way out. What I can help you with is to remove the barriers in that drive of the person to become frum. So what I'm trying to do to him is not really to convince him that there is a God, but allow him to remove the doubt as a barrier in his path towards Frumkeit, towards Yiddishkeit. Okay? So don't be surprised at all that you speak to a group or you speak to two people and you tell them exactly the same logic, the same proof. Like you tell them this proof. What do you mean? Look around you. You see a world where everything fits in. It's so perfect. And to one person, that is an overwhelming proof. And to the other person, they'll say, "Father, that's ridiculous. What do you mean?" So it happened to have worked this way, because if it could be any other way, we wouldn't have a world. Because you know that there is a counter-argument. The counter-argument against this proof, that obviously there must be a planner, because the world is too planned, there's a very easy counter-argument. The counter-argument is, fine, it's a world that somehow works, right? What are the chances of such a world being created by chance? 1 in a trillion, right? 1 in 10 trillion. Fine, so we are the result of that chance. You hear the counter-argument? It's a very easy counter-argument. Which means that we have no proof at all. In other words, it's the same thing as saying, if you buy a lottery ticket, what are the chances that you are going to win? 1 in 2 million. So what are the chances you're going to win? Minimal. But what about for the person who already won? You say, I won, but it's impossible. It's only 1 in 2 million. But someone wins, right? So you are the one that won, so we are the world which worked out according to the law of statistics. Maybe it was tried 10 trillion times, And we are the 10 trillionth yeah?
My echo of the topic to that is that this person, Joey, does not run his life on such a low probability. So why over here would we choose...
No. It's more than that, you see, because we are the result of that one in a trillion chance.
Why would you choose the view as why do you take that chance, that side of the argument as opposed to the other side? His whole life he runs with more probability.
We are coming to that. You mean to say, so at least let there be a doubt? That's what bothers you? Let at least be a sophic, a shokel? That's what you mean? But you realize that a proof you don't have anymore.
Yes,
you see, you don't have a proof anymore.
Side,
oh, so then, okay, I mean, I was going to talk about it a little bit later. Since you bring it up, yeah.
What type of people generally give this?
Oh, usually the above average in intelligence. The above average in intelligence will always come up with this counter. What?
Yeah, I know.
Do you have a theory why? Do you have a theory why the above average intellectual
answers like that? Oh, because, I mean, it's the one who is above average. What?
It's anti-intellectual.
Oh, no, just the opposite. It's very intellectual.
No, it's
oh,
much
no.
more intellectual to assume there's a planet. I mean, that's...
That's the intuition. The pure lat paket. It's just the opposite. It's just the opposite. Usually you have the intuitive type accepting this argument. And the purely logical type, the one who is probably like who is working on his master's in physics or in mathematics, will not accept this argument. Just the opposite. It's the purely intellectual who will not accept the argument. As a rule, I mean, it's a miracle, but as a rule, he will not accept it. It's the intuitive, right? The one who is involved in the social sciences or in philosophy, right? Sometimes, well, philosophy so-and-so, but so-so, but so those, the intuitive types, the ones involved in literature, right? Those are the ones who will hear it, who will sense it. Yeah, you are right. I mean, things are too perfect. I mean, things fit in too well. Right? Just the opposite. It's the purely intellectual who will reject the argument. He won't go for it. But there is another argument, and that's what, yeah.
Another argument yeah. I've heard from people is that it's not so perfect.
That's what?
That it's not so perfect.
That the world is not so perfect.
You have very, very ecological problems that are going on now, and if it was so perfect, then it would have made a world that we could have driven cars without pollution. Really, and
no, it's just, so it's fun. Man-made, Paquette. I mean, the point is, it is perfect, like... You know, scientists have a way of, you know, that there is, for instance, a Victor Miller. Did you ever see the books, a Victor Miller's books? He has what some of the examples, how the fruits, because of the skin, can survive. If there would be, if the skin would be too thick, it would rot. It would be too thin, the sun would destroy it. It has to be just exactly so in order for it to survive. Meaning, everything has to be just exactly so in order to survive. Too many things are just exactly so. In other words, if the distance between the sun and the earth would be like a few 100,000 miles more or less, we couldn't survive. We would either freeze or being burned down. I mean, if the atmosphere wouldn't be exactly so, we couldn't survive. There are too many things which are exactly so, or else we wouldn't be able to survive. I mean, that is, again, I mean, you can say each... specific thing, you know, that each argument is not acceptable, but all in all you do get the feeling that too many things are just so exact that there has to be a planner. Or like the counter argument says, because one world did survive out of the 10 trillion worlds which were tried before, so of course everything has to fit in, because otherwise it wouldn't have survived. Since we are the only surviving world, so we are the one in the 10 trillion, so therefore it's just by chance that it happened. Okay? Yeah.
What does it mean if they were tried before?
Again?
What does it mean if there were other...
Labdak, I'm just using it as a figure of speech. It's not a meaning. When you throw dice and you are looking for the number one, right? Sometimes it can come out on the first try. Sometimes it will come out on the sixth try, or sometimes it comes out on the tenth try. But it's just theoretically possible, right, that we are just the world that worked. That was by chance, all kinds of combinations of atoms happen in the world, right? And right away it was done it was made and destroyed, like boine oilom oisu machribon sort of, meaning it's created and destroyed because it just doesn't work out until finally one world really works.
I think Rishani mentioned this, many of the Rishani reports mentioned this proof. Why is there so much variation and rebuild in this world, which did develop as it did, let's say, to, you know, there doesn't have to be, in other words, everything was put together. You could take apart, let's say, we'll get rid of all the flies, or we'll get rid of all the grass, all the weeds, or something else. There could have been a lot less variety in the world. But we do see that so much variety, and it all runs according to the same rule.
Yeah, and what does that prove? A planner or natural development? Right?
Well,
you have Darwin's theory, which tells you.
Yeah, natural development, yeah.
I understand, but that's part of the thing, which means the variations is just part of the natural development. I mean, if you want to counter argue, I mean, you have the Darwin's theory of, you know, that eventually all combinations will happen and only the fittest will survive, and then other trillion combinations will happen, and again only the fittest will survive. You have that counter argument.
Isn't it true there can't be a proof 100%?
Exactly. That's the point. Exactly. It can be. There can by its very essence, it can be. Because the moment it's a proof like 2 and 2 is 4, right? Then again, there is no choice anymore. There has to be room for emunah. There has to be room for choice. But there is something else. There is a counter argument here. There is a sitter there. Can you pass me the sitter? I saw it as a pshat in Pirkei Avos. Listen to this very, very strange statement in Pirkei Avos. It says like this.
Where is it?
This is the second parrot. Vehevei mechashei hefsed mitzvot keneged schoro. It's a very, very strange statement. There are all kinds of pshotim, but the pshat, the simple pshat, is very difficult. When you do a mitzvah, think, hefsed mitzvah, what am I losing? Well, I'm losing money, it's costing me time, effort, right? But keneged schoro, look what I'm going to get, right? Schar. Uschar Aveiro, whenever you're going to do an Aveiro, think, fine, I'm going to do an Aveiro, I'm going to work on Shabbos, I'm going to become richer. But Keneged Efseido, look what you're losing. You're losing Olam Habo. So always think of both sides. Why do I have to think of both sides? Yeah? Whenever I'm doing a mitzvah, think of the Hefsed of the mitzvah. In other words, whenever I'm going to buy a pair of film, think about it. You know, it's costing you $500. It's a lot of money. But on the other hand, look at the merit that you're going to get. Why do the Chazal tell me that I have to weigh? Why should I weigh it all? Why shouldn't I say, money? What's money? Can I get the schar? What's the idea of hevei mechashev hefsed mitzvah can I get schar? Schar aveiro can I get seido? So, in some of the Meforshim, they say that this is talking to a specific person, like a lot of the statements in Pirkei Avos are talking to a specific person with specific thoughts and with specific problems. This particular person that this statement in Pirkei Avos is talking to is a person with sfeikas. He has doubts. Right? He has doubts. Should I do a mitzvah or shouldn't I do a mitzvah? Why should he have doubts whether he should do the mitzvah or not? Because he's not a believer. He doesn't know, certainly, whether there was a Matan Torah or there was a God, he doesn't know. He thinks of that as a possibility. So now he has to figure out, is it worth it for me to give my life up to do mitzvahs, or isn't it worth it for me to give up my life to do mitzvahs? Meaning, if you're 100% believer, if you have emunah shleimo, you don't have to be mechashev. There is no hefsed. You don't consider the hefsed at all. So obviously we are talking to a person who is not certain. Now, the analogy used is the following. Let's say, for instance, I would tell you, I have a perfect idea for an investment for you, right? You can invest $1,000, right? There is a 50-50 chance that you will make at the end of the year an extra $100, right? You know, so at the end of the year, you are going to get $1,100. But there is a 50-50 chance that you lose it all. Right? Now, is that a good investment? Ridiculous. Of course, a terrible investment. Because look, there is a 50-50 chance, right, that you may lose it all. And if you win, you only win $100. Right? In other words, the return doesn't cover for the chance. What about if I tell you a different case? I tell you like this. You have an extra $1,000. Good, invested with me. There is a 50-50 chance that you are going to get, or even more. Let's change it. There is a 20% chance that from the $1,000 you're going to make $1 million at the end of the year. You hear, you're going to become a millionaire with $1,000. There is a 20% chance or a 10% chance you'll become a millionaire. But there is a 90 or an 80% chance you may lose it all. Right? Assuming you can afford the $1,000, is that a good investment or not? It's an excellent investment. It's an excellent investment. I would do it all the time. Why? Because obviously the return overweighs the chance. You understand what I mean? That the return overweighs the chance. Meaning the return of $100 is not sufficient to overweigh the chance of 50-50. But the return of $1 million, right, definitely overturns even the chance of 10 out of 100. Do you understand the logic behind it? Because there's such a thing as chance and a return. Small return, right, I won't take a chance. For a large return, I will take a chance.
Yes, risk-reward ratio.
Exactly, that's what they call it, the risk-reward ratio. There has to be a logical risk-reward ratio. In other words, if the reward is sufficient, I will be willing to take a larger risk. Right? That is the idea behind it, and it's a purely logical idea. Now, if a person is considering, should I accept Judaism or shouldn't I accept Judaism? That's his choice, right? Here's his choice. And you say, well, you have to be certain in order to accept Judaism. Not at all. This is what the Mishnah is telling you. You can base your commitment to Judaism on doubt, on uncertainty. You can be uncertain and it's still 100% logical for you to become a committed Jew. How? With the same example as the investment. Right? Let's assume that a person gave up his life to do mitzvahs. He became a religious Jew. And he comes to the world to come, right? And then he's laughed at. Why, come on, what a fool you were. Look what you lost. So many Shabbosim you could have gone to the beach. It's all nonsense. It's all nonsense. So what did you lose, right? So you lost, like the Mesilas Yeshurim says, right? So you lost 70 years, right? Assuming the best, right? That you could have had tremendous fun on Shabbos and you had to end up, you know, eating chowder in your house and going to shul, right? And you could have done who knows how many averes that you missed out. It's not so great. I mean, you know, lemaisa, it's not such a great world. You know, it doesn't give you that many pleasures. But even assuming the best life, right? So you missed out, right? So, enochinami, you missed out and now you have nothing for it. But let's assume the other way around. Let's assume, right, that you make a choice not to become committed to Judaism, right? And then you are going to have tremendous pleasures. You're going to do all kinds of averes. You can eat in the best restaurants, right? And then at the end, you'll come to the next world, and then you'll be laughed at. You say, come on, you had a chance, and you didn't accept it. Then you are doomed eternally, right? Because you had the choice and you refused it, right? So that means that forever and ever and ever, right, you are going to have to pay the price for that choice. So consider the risk-reward ratio, right? What does that tell you logically? That even if it's not right, you didn't lose so much, right? So you made an investment and you lost it, but look what you could have gained. Let's say you did commit yourself to Yiddishkeit, and it is emes, you'll have eternal reward. Isn't it kedai? Comes out that by pure risk-reward ratio, you can commit yourself to Yiddishkeit based on uncertainty. You don't need certainty to become a committed Jew. I just want to conclude that this is the pshat in the Mishnah. What does the Mishnah say? Hevei mechashev hefsed mitzvah keneged schoro. What is the Mishnah telling you? If you have doubts, just consider, what is the hefsed of the mitzvah? I'm going to do so many pleasures, right? So many shabbosim that I could have gone to the beach. But look at the reward ratio, right? Kineget choro, le'oilom vo'ed, le'oilom vo'ed. You are going to be rewarded for the Shabbos that you kept. Uschar aveiro, oh, you went to a top restaurant, you had a tremendous pork chop. So you didn't have the tremendous pork chop. Uschar kineget hefsedo, look what you could have you could lose if you are wrong. And Yiddishkeit is taka right, which means that you can make a commitment out of uncertainty. So that's why when you ask, but a logical person will accept it, it's 100% true. If he's really logical and honest, he will become a committed Jew out of uncertainty. Yeah.
What would you answer if somebody says, yeah, I hear the argument, it's very good, but the Christians, the Buddhists, the Zoroastrians,
right,
the Muslims,
that
everybody's
is, yeah,
going to
say, right, this is why, I don't know if you noticed, but in the beginning, I told you, if a person has the following choice in front of him, either to accept or reject Yiddishkeit. That is the choice in front of him, right? In such a situation, this argument works, but you are 100% right. This is not an argument to convince somebody out of the blue that he has to become a religious Jew. It's only if that is the choice in front of him. Why? Because the counter argument is that every single ideology and religion in the world can give the same argument, right? They can say, well, why should you take a chance? You don't follow us. And we say follow us, so if so, and the double so, right? This is why I introduce the argument only in a situation when the person actually sees either one way or the other. In other words, it doesn't occur to him to become a Christian or a Muslim. It's either yes or not to accept Yiddishkeit. So then you have a very strong argument that even out of uncertainty, you have to accept Yiddishkeit. Now, yeah.
I want to offer a counter argument.
Yeah, go ahead.
First of all, in a sense, you're dealing with a sex thing. Because first the person has to believe that the other side exists.
In other words, if you're 100% sure that it's wrong, then there is no argument. That's what you mean.
Right.
If you're 100% sure that it's wrong.
That Olam Haba is a fantasy.
Right.
So how am I going to believe
that? 100%. 100%. But I want to tell you, I have never, as of now, I have never met an ideological, certain atheist. I'm looking for them. You know, I'm really looking for a real argument with a real atheist. Now, someone who is committed, who is 100% certain that what I believe is nonsense. I want to meet him. I've never met such a person yet.
I'm not saying you have to be 100% certain. I'm saying it reduces the odds.
It doesn't matter. That's why I mentioned 10%. It doesn't have to be a Sofek HaShoko. Even if it's a possibility of 1 out of 10, right?
No, but you could carry that farther and say, since nobody has ever witnessed, you can't see the microscope, nobody has ever witnessed this mysterious world.
So what? But it's a possible world.
So therefore, I don't take that into the statistics. Not
well,
the equation,
that doesn't make sense. I mean, if it's a possible world.
The Ramban says that on the Rishta, the Chavev Rosh Hashoim, that they did not believe anything, what they couldn't feel with their hands or
that's part of the Rishas. That's part of the subjectivity. In other words, since you want to commit yourself to a better life, so your Yetzer Hora doesn't allow you to hear this argument, right? But if you present it to him, there is no actual counter-argument. The only counter-argument is this. I believe it's definitely nonsense, right? That is the only real counter-argument. The point is, even though it's such a logical argument, there are some people who are unwilling to listen to this argument. Oh, that makes them a Roshe. That's only because you are Be'etzem a Roshe. Right? That's the point. But an actual counter-argument, there is no counter-argument to this, except if he tells you that he's a believing atheist. You know that atheism is a religion, right? There is no one as, you know, closed-minded as an atheist, probably, I imagine, right? He's not willing to listen to any other side, right?
Let me just offer a comparable case to what we're talking about. Let's say somebody who had a very bad illness, and he has an opportunity to take an operation which has a chance of working, not a very good chance. Or a person says, there's another option. Somebody comes over to him and he says, I know of a different type of a science that exists. No one has ever heard of it before. But this science has almost 100% success rate. Now, the person has never heard of the science before. Would he be foolish to choose the what he has heard of because it has a small possibility of working? Or should he go for what I'm telling him exists, which he's never heard of and doesn't believe? But I know, I'm telling him, I know that this has a very high percentage. It's almost for sure you'll be cured with this.
You know, if he has confidence in you or he doesn't have confidence in you, you mean? No, that's the crucial point. Does he have confidence in you? And I'm not just mentioning this, the confidence part, because this is another crucial point here.
Why is it?
The main point is that you have to develop the sense that he trusts you. Right? He has to trust you that such a thing exists.
But that's my point. That this in itself can't work without a trust. And if it's built on a trust, then it's not a proof.
Well, it's not so. It's not exactly so. You mean, even the alternative you mean is a non-existent until...
And then it's not a proof, it's a trust.
Exactly. But there is something else. It's the knowledge that Judaism exists. It's also something. Which means, it's not something that out of the blue I come to me and say, you know there's a religion called Judaism? Yeah, I never heard of it. Right? And then I say, yeah, there is, and you have to do mitzvahs, you have to put on tefillin. Says, yeah? Really? Okay. And then, trust is crucial. Of course, trust is very important, but after all, Judaism is something that he probably knows exists. Right? So it's a little bit different than what you are talking about. Right? The analogy would be that there is a science. For instance, somebody tells you, you know, the Chinese have been using this and this method for years and it works. Right? Why don't you try that? Right? Then, of course, if the combination. I know the Chinese. I know that they have acupuncture, for instance, and that it does. I heard Stuckey, that for them it does work. I never considered it as an alternative. But now that you mention it, the combination of my trust in you, your mentioning it, and my knowledge that the Chinese use acupuncture could make me change my mind. Enochinami. That's it. That would be a good analogy. Right? Now, by the way, many people ask, but doesn't it say that emuno is only an emuno shleimo? What does it mean, ani mamim be'emuno shleimo? Did I ever tell you a pshat in ani mamim be'emuno shleimo? Did I tell you a pshat? Could be that I mentioned it to you. What does it mean, ani mamim be'emuno shleimo? Does ani mamim be'emuno shleimo mean that I'm not allowed to have any doubts at all? Or is there room in belief in emuno for doubts? Or is it a contradiction? Right? A person says, and that is something that comes up very, very often, somebody tells you, listen, I believe and I'm committed, but I can't help it, I have doubts. Does that make me an eino maimin? What do you answer to such a thing? Right? Yeah?
The very definition of I believe means I believe, I'm not 100% sure.
You're 100% right, but that very, very few people take it that way.
I think
very many people mistakenly believe that there is a contradiction between emuno and doubt. Right? But that's what I want to tell you. You're 100% right. There is no contradiction. I'll explain to you right away. Yeah.
I believe the Brisker of defined emuna. Whatever Seichel can understand is not in the tzchum of emuna. That's the idea that a person has to understand. What Seichel cannot be mastered, that is not emuna.
That's exactly. It's 100% right. I never heard of Bishem the Brisker of, but it's 100%. So it's obviously emes what he's saying. In other words, that today is Thursday. Tonight is Thursday night is not emuna. Right? That now it's dark outside, it's not emuno. That 2 and 2 is 4 is not emuno. It's like it says, you know, in Chazal say, Lahagid baboiker chazdecho vemunoscho baleilois. Right? You say in the morning, in other words, when things are clear, when you see things clearly, then you can see the chesed of Hashem. At night, when everything is dark, you can't see the chesed of Hashem. So when is there emuno? At night there is emuno. In the day there is yedio, there is no emuno. Lehagid baboiker chazdecho vemunoso baleilois. Hashem Elokeichem emes. What do we say in the morning? V'yatziv v'nochoin v'kayom. All synonyms of an established fact. What do we say at night? V'emuno kol zois. Because at night, Hashem Elokeichem emes is connected to emuno. Because you have to make what the philosophers call the leap of faith. Because it's not a yedio bruro, right? It's a commitment to something. That's why Hashem Elokechem emes ve'emuno, that's only at night. During the day, it's beyond the emuno. It's yedio. It's yedio, right? Of course, there is such a thing as an emuno, which is as intense as the yedio. But I use the following analogy. Let's say, for instance, a doctor, a surgeon. A surgeon has to think whether yes to make the operation or not to make the operation. So we weigh the possibilities. I may yes make the operation and this will come out, but he, if he does succeed, he will have a better life, or I may not make the operation. And if I don't make the operation, he may live anyway. I mean, so he has all kinds of tzedot in yes to make the operation and not to make the operation. Let's give it values. He adds values on this side of the scale, this side of the scale. It comes out 60-40 that he should make the operation. 60-40, but just by giving it numbers. So he decides he's going for it, right? Or 70-30, whatever. Okay? While he's making the operation, does his uncertainty affect his commitment to the operation? In other words, will he do 70% of the cure? It's ridiculous. Obviously, you make 100% commitment to the 70% chance. You hear what I mean? Which means the chances are really 70%, but my commitment is 100%. Right? In other words, ani ma'amin b'emuno shlemo doesn't mean I have no uncertainty. I can have as many uncertainties as I want. Doesn't matter. But my commitment is to the tzad that it's emes. Which means that there is no contradiction at all between doubts and emuno. Emuno has to do with your commitment to something. Right? Your doubts in your head, you're allowed to have as many doubts as you want. As long as your commitment is to 100%, like the doctor making the operation. He still has doubts, but it doesn't affect his commitment. Now, as far as termin ha-shamayim, there is the classical argument, which is very, very powerful. If you develop the skill of bringing it out, this can even be a good argument, both for Torah min ha-shamayim and, of course, for the existence of God, because one is telling the other, right? If Torah is min ha-shamayim, there has to be a shamayim, right? Like so some people say, you know, that there was one of the criticisms on some Hasidim. They say, nu, this Hasid, he has a emuno shleimo in his Rebbe, that his Rebbe has Ruach HaKodesh. He's not so sure there is a God, but for sure his Rebbe is Ruach HaKodesh. That's one of the criticisms. You know, like, and there are. I mean, I don't know if you ever met this paradox. A man who believes blindly in his Rebbe, but from his actions, you see, he's not a real Maimin Bashem, you know. But Lemaise, if you prove to someone Terem in Hashemayim, logically, right, he has to believe in Hashem. The way I express it, this is something which is already mentioned in the Kuzari, in the Hakdome of the Sefer Achinuch, but the way I present it is the following way. Each one should develop his own skill in presenting it, but because if you present it well, it's a very powerful argument. I called it the theory of the first fool. What does it mean, the theory of the first fool? Point is like this. If I believe in something, right, if I know something, for instance, I know that George Washington was a president in the United States. I know that. If you analyze how I know that, it will come out that for specific reasons. Because this and this teacher told me, I read it in this book, and I read it in the New York Times, and I read it here, and I read it there. Right. So if somebody will say, now, it's all a plot to convince you that there was a president called George Washington. Now, I would reject it immediately. I would say, why would anybody want to fool me? I know my parents told me there was a president George Washington. My teachers told me. There is no reason for them to fool me, right? Counter-argument. Your parents themselves were convinced by someone that there was a George Washington. They really believed that, but somebody convinced them. Oh, so go one step further. The people who convinced them, why should have they convinced my parents that there was a man called George Washington, right? It's so illogical. So obviously you have to come up with the following answer. There must have been a first one who was a complete fool. And that complete naive fool accepted blindly what he was told, and then he told it over to his children. Now, in order to apply this to Torah min ha-shamayim, you have to go a lot further. You must create the following scenario, right? In order to deny Torah min ha-shamayim, now it's Maimad Har Sinai, in order to deny it, you have to say that at some point between Sinai and today, right, someone came to the Jew, to all our ancestors, right, and told them, you see this book? No, we never saw it before in our lives. Ah, this is the book that your ancestors received on Mount Sinai. Right? And that obligates you to put on tefillin every day and to keep Shabbos. And they all said, really? What a surprise. And my parents never told me this. Oh, yeah, you have to. Ah, okay, let's accept it. Our parents, our forefathers were in Sinai. So my children will have to do it. In other words, a whole generation suddenly became extremely naive and foolish. And they all accepted from some trickster, right? Such an incredible theory. Is that possible? If that is very illogical, what is the only other alternative? That it actually happened. There is no other alternative. If you don't accept the theory of the first fool, then the only other alternative is the fact that my Matar Sinai really happened. There is no other alternative in the middle. Do you hear the point? Yeah? Yeah.
Then you can have a counter-argument and you see the same thing happen in Christianity.
No, you don't. I mean, usually you have that, it's a common thing. Right away they ask you this, right? They ask you this. What about the Muslims and the Christians? They claim the same thing. Someone who made a study of comparative religions found the following incredible fact. Incredible. Every single religion in the world, besides the Jewish religion, are all based on one person. Not two, not three, one. That's all. Right? In other words, the whole Christianity is based on Paul, right? That's all. Now, he claims that he got a that from now on you don't have to accept the Torah and whatever. What about if he either was lying or he was fooled? And obviously, it's one person. I mean, how reliable is one person? Islam, obviously, one person.
The whole door.
Fine, but they all accept that it's one person.
We
are the only mechutzofin, right? That we claim that at least 4 million people. Although I says, we're all there. It wasn't one, it wasn't two, it's 4 million. You hear? What are the chances that 4 million were all fooled? As opposed to the fact that one person was fooled, right?
It could be that one person was fooled that there were 4 million.
That why?
There was the first fool who was fooled that he had 4 million ancestors who were...
But I don't understand. How did he transfer that? At which time... Did the 4 million become one?
One could have become 1 million.
There was no 4 million.
It was only one. It was only one.
There was one claiming there was
who,
4 million.
Who made it up, right? And he came to whom?
To somebody.
To other ancestors.
Someone like Paul, who's very powerful and can start.
One person. Okay, now, do we have, first of all, we must have had a record of that. Moshe Rabbeinu. Who was it? Moshe Rabbeinu. Look, it says in the book that we were there. In other words, again, you're accepting the first fool theory.
What? Yeah.
The first fool, right? You know, all our ancestors at a certain point. In other words, you can't. In order to go back to one, you have to go back before Har Sinai. That was after Har Sinai. We were a people. So he came to our ancestors, and they all accepted that even though their parents never told them this. Right? There was a Maimon Har Sinai with 4 million people, so you have to accept the first fool theory.
And you see it happen by Paul.
No, it never happened by Paul.
He didn't fool
anybody. They all said, Paul says such and such. I mean, he didn't fool anybody. Do you understand what I'm saying? Meaning, he didn't fool anybody. He presented the facts to people. People accepted his facts, and they say over, we heard from Paul such and such. They don't say, we heard it from God. They say, we heard it from Paul. Which means, you can't fool a whole world. Right? We are the only ones who tried to fool a whole world that 4 million people were there. You know, we are the only one with the chutzpah of making such a claim. So it's one of the two. Either it's an outrageous chutzpah or it's true. One of the two. It's a powerful argument. Think about it. It's an extremely powerful argument.
We all came from Amorim. We all stem from one person. At one point or another, they can say, and maybe that one person...
That's the point. You know, in many forum it says, why wasn't the Torah given to Avraham Avinu? Mm-hmm. Because he was one.
Okay, but
and
was
we
given,
didn't want one.
For, so if you fooled one person, then he can tell his theorists that they're all...
But you can't. In other words...
My Matar Sinai was afterwards.
Right. You know,
I have a guy who said, I was at Har Sinai.
But that's the point. You...
In other words, again, you have to say that they came to our ancestors, and again, they fooled our ancestors that there were 4 million people. So again, you are basing the whole theory on the theory of the first fool. So that's the way you have to present it. If this is acceptable to you, it's possible that all our ancestors were naive fools. There is such a possibility. We can't prove otherwise. But if it's reasonable to you, okay, fine. So then deny Maimad Har Sinai. But if that possibility is unreasonable to you, you must admit the only other possibility is that it's MS. So if you want to live with the first fool theory, I can't deny it to you. I can't refuse it. I can't reject it. But if that doesn't satisfy you, right, then you have no choice but to accept Torah Min HaShamayim. Now it's Maimad Har Sinai. Yeah?
This isn't foolproof, but I can imagine that someone would ask this from an audience that at the end of World War II, the whole world saw that the destruction of habit.
Basically, you are right. That's what the Enlightenment is saying. But remember, we are not in the Enlightenment anymore. And those people committed to the belief that we are modern and our ancestors are primitive, that is changing now. In other words, we are developing respect for our ancestors. There is a return to more respect to our ancestors. In the Haskole, there was an extreme of the other side, right? It was a complete putting down of our ancestors. Our ancestors knew nothing, we know everything. Now there is a feeling of respect of the ancestors. So it's true. The Haskola Jew, the Maskil, can live with that. Yeah, my ancestors were dumb and naive. Yeah, and they accepted the foolish theory that there was a Maimed Har Sinai. Yeah. But the Jew today, he's only an unbeliever out of inertia. If you present them with the facts, the chances are that it will hit them. It will hit them. Remember, we are away from that ideological commitment of the Enlightenment. It's gone. It's gone forever. That's it.
Standard college kids today believe that his parents were, that they might be nice people, worthy of respect. I should get them a glass of water when they ask. But ask them whether their grandparents or great-grandparents were doing the right thing when they believed in all these weird superstitions. They'll still tell you that they were sold a load of...
They were wrong, but the extreme of feeling that they were primitive savages that you had in a century and a half ago, that was actually what they expressed, actually, our primitive, savage ancestors, you don't have anymore. There is much more respect now in a Jew for his ancestry than the masculine, than the average masculine. I don't know if you ever read Haskola literature. It's disgusting, you know. It's not only lack of respect for the ancestry, it's hatred for the ancestry. It's an actual feeling of hatred. It's as if we blame our ancestry for all the problems we had being Jewish. So there was an actual hatred. You don't have that anymore. You know, the hatred of my ancestors because I'm Jewish. Just the opposite. I'm pretty proud of being Jewish.
That's a natural reaction for what they consider emancipation.
That was the problem with emancipation. Emancipation was a whole blaming trip for our ancestors.
For what they were doing.
Exactly, exactly. Exactly. That was the idea. You don't have that anymore. If you have that, you can't argue anything. You know, there is no argument at all. You're absolutely right. To the maskil, you have no argument. Right. But today it's different. We don't maskil him anymore. You know. Okay. Now. To start the next subject, it's a little bit late. Any other questions on this subject, Torah Min HaShamayim? Yeah,
this is a question. I just want to remember, as the point that was made, that to have a moon does not necessarily mean to be 100% sure.
Right.
But at the same time, to say that a person is going to do 100% the Torah and have a large suffix is hard to come by, isn't it?
Why? Why?
Because it means a tremendous amount of serious nefesh at times and commitment.
Yeah.
And
for the chance that it's true.
But speaking from a just realistic point of view, it's good if everything's going smoothly with a person who's trying to keep the Torah, fine. So he can say, I'll keep the Torah even though I'm not sure. But when things start to become difficult, and he has to make decisions of which way to go.
You are right. At that time, you're 100% right. Therefore, your obligation in such a situation is to minimize the doubt. Of course.
Of course. How do you do that?
Well, of course. I mean, that's part of the process, to minimize the doubt. But I'm just saying that the first commitment, which is the crucial commitment, the first step of the commitment, does not require the removal of doubts. Right? That's what I mean. Now, if you wanted to make that step, you want him to make that step, the first commitment, and he says, but I can't, I have so many doubts. Say, okay, it's okay. You can have as many doubts as you want. And you present to him this risk-reward ratio, and then he feels comfortable becoming committed in spite of his doubts. And you know the klal is tamo ureu kitoy Hashem, that somehow the doing mitzvahs will eventually, little by little, it makes the questions, the doubts, irrelevant. You know the famous pshat that the Malbim gives on Iyov, that all, he had a lot of questions, right? And then at the end he says, Hamishma oizen shmaticho. The questions at the end, Hashem appears to Iyov. So he says, Hamishma oizen shmaticho. The reason why I had questions is because I only heard about you. The ato einai risicho. Now my experience is so real that all of a sudden the question disappeared. So the mother, what do you mean? But the questions are still there. Where is the justice? Right? All of a sudden, your feeling of certainty takes away the questions, even though you don't have an answer. But little by little,
isn't that what we call self-deception and brainwashing?
Yes, but it's the good side of it. You understand? I mean, it is. I mean, there's no question about it. There's no question about it. It's self-suggestion, and sometimes it can be used in the good side. Right? That is the good side of it. Exactly. You can use it in order to become a committed communist, right? Or you can use it to become a committed Jew, right? But you have the choice, and it's to allow yourself to become brainwashed. But that is a commitment that a Jew should make, by the way, right? Because the eventual disappearance of all doubts is only through self-suggestion and brainwashing. But it's something that you have a choice to allow yourself to get into it, to the point that all of a sudden that doubts disappear, right? Even though they are there, but they disappear, they dissipate. Yeah.
But once I've been faced with this one, that in terms of my ancestors had to believe that 4 million people were there, why don't we just convince, let's say, maybe not 4 million, 100,000 people. Moshe Rabbeinu is very charismatic, he has a group of elders, he has a few people, it makes logical, we live together, we make laws, it makes a lot of sense, it's humanistic, it's moral, it's fair, it's ethical. And we say that it was given by God, but it wasn't really given by God. We all made up. Yeah, and we'll tell it to our children. And we'll tell it that they all got it from Hashem. So therefore, you don't have to convince anybody anymore. Once you convince only the first generation, 100,000 people or 20,000
so
people.
So remember, those people have to get together to agree, all of them, to give over the same tradition to the next generation.
On a fraud,
exactly. If that's logical, again is the theory. If they were all fooled into accepting that commitment, fine, okay, we have no argument against it. But does that make sense to you? That all our ancestors all agreed? Look at the book itself, look at Korach, right? If there would be any doubt about Maimar Har Sinai, this man would have accepted it, right? Right. No, I'm saying like the Korach, the story of Korach is the biggest riot for Torah Min HaShemayim, right? Because Lemaise, he never said that Torah is not Min HaShemayim. He never said it. He never said that Moshe Rabbeinu made up the Torah. Most he could argue was that Moshe Rabbeinu gave certain positions to certain people. He never argued that Moshe Rabbeinu made up the Torah. If there would be any chance of arguing that Moshe Rabbeinu made up the Torah, wouldn't Korach come up with that possibility?
If right? He would have made it up, they wouldn't have put that in the book.
Fine, but remember, one thing we sense about the Torah, I mean, but it's getting a little bit too complex, because one thing we do sense about the Torah is the complete objectivity of the Torah. You know, that's a tremendous argument. That's the complete objectivity of the Torah, which means all flaws, all problems are never covered up, right? If there was a problem, Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake, so he made a mistake. It's right there. Right? Korach, whatever happened by Korach, there was a revolution. It's right there. We don't create ideal situations in the book, right? Everything was perfect. No, everything is open, honest, right here. Right? That itself gives you a feeling of certainty that what it says actually happened. Because why should you try to... If there was... It's megamati. What do you call megamati? In other words, if the whole book is how do you translate megamati? If it like a book with a certain like
goal oriented,
what?
Goal
goal-oriented, meaning it has the goal. The goal is to convince you. It would have covered up all the bad parts. Right? It would have covered up Moshe Rabbeinu making a mistake. I mean, I have to rely on Moshe Rabbeinu, the same Moshe Rabbeinu who hits the stone? Well, you know, I have to accept that my ancestors, tried to kill each other, right? Why? You know, why don't we all cover it up? If it's all a plot, they would have written a much better book, right?
You know, that's a different argument. That's not the argument of the Kuzari.
Well, it's part of the argument of the Kuzari. Part of the argument of the Kuzari. He doesn't actually say that, but it's in there. The absolute objectivity of the Torah, right?
That's
that once the book.
To me, that's a better argument than the argument.
Well, it's part of the argument because the whole argument is the book. Give him the book and say, could this book, by its very nature, be made up by someone and sold to a whole generation? Look at the nature of it. It doesn't say what is there in the book that makes it impossible to be so. That's I'm adding. The complete objectivity of Torah is overwhelming, right? If somebody's trying to sell someone something, he wouldn't write a Torah. It's ridiculous. It's not a book that can be sold. Right? I mean, my ancestors made this and this mistake. I mean, the New Testament would write such a thing about, you know, Paul. And, I mean, it's ridiculous. Would the Quran write about, out of the question. They were all perfect. All of a sudden, you see, they're all human. It's part of the argument that this book is not a book that you can just fool people into accepting. It's either it happened or it's not. Yeah.
Humanistic argument. I mean, someone close to me says it's humanistic. It's ethical. It's logical. People got together. It's beautiful.
The truth of the matter is, it's not humanistic at all. I mean, why is the Torah humanistic? Right. The Torah says that you destroy all the Canaanites. What's humanistic about that? It doesn't say that you make peace with the Canaanites. It says you get rid of them, right? You get rid of Amalek. Where's the humanism of it? By the way, I don't know if you saw, there's a in this week's Time magazine. Did anybody have a chance to see it? Right?
Oh,
you have it right here?
I made a copy for Shula.
Oh. Did you read that argument about we have to do better than Yeshua? I mean, it's a beautiful. I mean, we are talking about a so-called Orthodox Jew, a philosopher. Can you, if you have the thing, can you read it? What's his? Can you read that part? It's an incredible thing. It's an incredible statement. You're talking about humanism. We are more humanistic than God. That's what the man is arguing, right?
Oh, he quotes right in, Joshua didn't convene an international peace conference, he just drove out the pagans out. We must find a different
way. Here, we must find a different way. You're the argument. In other words,
who's the attribution?
Who's saying that?
Yeah.
An Orthodox philosopher. Right? Well, how is he quoted? How is he described as the greatest philosopher, Jewish philosopher of our generation? How is he quoted?
No, that stands out.
Oh, yes,
in a nation where state and religion are often indistinguished from Hartman's question and transcends academic argument.
Of David Hartman.
Right. Right. David Hartman wants to create that Torah that's really humanistic. He doesn't like God's Torah. He wants, you know. That's what he says.
He's a religious philosopher.
He's a
philosopher. Right? I mean,
what's
if it's.
We have to do better than
yours. That's what I'm saying. The Torah is not humanistic. We are. So we have to create our own humanistic Torah. So it's not, the Torah is not so humanistic.
If you didn't say that I can have doubts and still be fully committed, that's fine if I'm going to do mitzvahs. I say mitzvahs, I say mitzvahs. When it comes to certain mitzvahs that have to do that I believe, how can you tell me if I have doubts that then there's a mitzvah and Imam Menu Shalem, they're going to take me to Din B'cheshbon if I didn't believe in Mashiach? But I had doubts in the whole thing to begin with.
Sure, but in your actions, do you commit yourself to Mashiach or not?
What does that have to do with my
It means I am committed 100% to his coming. Now do everything that is required, right? But I still have doubts. What does that have to do with
I
that?
I have doubts whether he's coming. That's not an imam.
I'm saying. An imami means I'm committed 100% to the idea. The same whether the doctor is committed that the operation is right. Does he have doubts? Of course. But he's still committed to it. Yeah.
Have you used the arguments that the Gemara gives for the proofs of Gemara gives for Kadosh Shemayim?
Which The arguments, the point is, I don't know enough about zoology to be able to use it. I hate to use arguments that I know very, very little about, because it just might happen that somebody knows about it more than me, and that's it, I'm lost. So I don't use, you know, that the Gemara says, what the Moshe Rabbeinu, how did he know that there was no animal which with the two simo, the, with the with one semen that besides the chazir, you know, with the split hooves besides the chazir? How did he know that? Right. Fine. I mean, then there are problems. I don't know if you know the problem with the rabbit. There's a major problem. This is why it's very dangerous to use it. You know that according to the Torah, the shofon is one of those animals. That according to what does it say in Parsha Shmini?
Maligero is not Mafis Parso.
It's Maligero, and it's not Mafis Parso. The truth of the matter is that the shofon is not Maligero.
So there was a different shofon.
Oh, so that's why. Oh, that is a different shofon. Once you say that, you have destroyed the argument. You see, our argument is, you see, we know exactly, and Moshe Rabbeinu knew
that. Where the shofon was.
Oh, exactly. So that's the point. So the point is, whatever counter argument you are going to, you say, oh, so that is a different animal.
No, not the rabbit. Still, who told you? How do you know that a rabbit?
I don't know that. I
so
don't
what
know.
What are you arguing?
You're 100% right. But if so, you have destroyed the Gemara's argument. Why? What does the Gemara say? It must be Torah min haShamayim, because Moshe Rabbeinu says, right, that the chazir is the only animal, right, who has split hoofs. Right, and not Maligero, the only animal. How did he know that in China they won't find another one? How do you know what a chazir is? Maybe that animal that you are going to find, you're going to call a chazir.
But still, there are more than
why not? I mean, you're going to call all of them chazir. Why not? I mean, maybe a chazir is a type which includes both. You have destroyed the argument. In other words, the moment you use that, you have destroyed the argument. This is why it's so dangerous. So I personally never use that. Even though I know in the discovery program they do use it, that's what they told me, and I don't know what they do about the shofon. You know, by the way, the Torah Shleimo.
Shofon v'anevis,
it says. Yeshofon v'anevis, but the rabbit doesn't fit into either one of them, and it's very difficult that all of a sudden we lost the tradition of what a shofon is. It's very, very difficult, but there is in the Torah Shleimo, you know, in the Torah Shleimo in the back, he is a beautiful, beautiful pshat. It's a beautiful, beautiful pshat, which, again, I would have to ask an expert whether it's true, because if it's true, it's amazing. The rabbit, supposedly, when he does his needs, right, afterwards, eats part of what he came out of him. So he says, wait a second. Maybe that's pshat maligero. How do you know what maligero? Maligero means that he uses twice the same food. Maybe that's pshat using twice the same food. That's male.
It takes back.
That's exactly pshat. It's an amazing pshat. And if it's true, it's tremendous. Right? I don't know. I never checked it out. But if you're an expert in the area, use it. Right? If not, keep away from arguments that you're not an expert in.